You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're not ashamed of not being ashamed. Trump hysteria reached new levels recently when protesters blocked the road to his rally in Arizona. At the same time, there was an anti-Trump rally being held in New York City. And finally, I recently read a Washington Post story by a black female college student in which she bragged about yelling "Black Lives Matter" at a Trump rally in North Carolina. To all of these events, I ask, what are you protesting? I understand that you don't like Trump. I don't either. But let's be real here. He is not Hitler or any sort of approximation of that villain. Are you really protesting someone's right to run for president because you don't like him? So then, what you're saying is, no one should be allowed to run for president without your permission. But wait, isn't that the purpose of primaries and the subsequent general election? You get to have a voice in the process, your vote. I'm not saying that trying to convince others to change their mind about a candidate is wrong. I'm saying that when you cross the line into disrupting and attempting to stop others from assembling because you've convinced yourself that disagreement with you is tantamount to evil, then you have become more evil than the evil you're attempting to stop. Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. If forced to, Daniel, how would you disrupt a Trump rally?
I thought with the strange pronunciation of my name there that you were getting at my answer, which is I think my half-Mexican nature showing up to a Trump rally would be disruptive in and of itself.
Now I have to leave that in.
I know. I like it. It doesn't take much to disrupt a Trump rally. They are... I seem to think the older white racist version of a mosh pit, just sort of looking to beat the fuck out of someone, and why not you?
For no reason.
Well, I think they would give you a reason. It would be a stupid reason, but it would be a reason. Like, you wanted damn Mexicans, or, you got more teeth than me, so.
I'm surprised. Not hard. That is a surprisingly accurate representation of a mosh pit from someone who listens to classical music.
Thank you. Thank you. I am in touch with what you kids call the music.
Also joining us this week via Skype from the hills of white privilege, James Elias. James, why is no one protesting Hillary Clinton?
So my name, we actually got right this time. I've been Elias this whole time, unbeknownst to the audience. I was hiding my real name. It's Elias, not Elias. Anyway, just had to bust Justin's balls there for a minute.
That is a really good question. Bust me on the one time I get it right. Like, all the other times when I got it wrong, you just let it go.
Well, everyone calls me Elias so much, I kind of forget what my name it actually is. Like, oh yeah, I'm Elias. Like, fine, that's just what people call me. So, yeah, but that's a really good question. Why is, you'd think with the sort of dichotomy that's been drawn between Bernie Sanders, you know, the guy who doesn't accept corporate money, and Hillary Clinton, the establishment Democrat candidate, you'd think you'd see a lot more, protesting of Hillary Clinton.
Emails and Benghazi and all that crap.
Well, I mean, I was never expecting to see, you know, leftists protesting over that sort of thing. You know, neither, I feel like not, one big problem, with our system is that neither side is willing to call its own people out when they do something wrong. And then, except for the Republicans are willing to do that when someone doesn't do something wrong, they're willing to call their own people out. But it seems like, you know, it's too much like, you know, a football game wherein even when the ref makes a good call, the team that was on the losing end of that call is still going to boo. I think we've lost, I think with a big problem in our system, we've lost objectivity. And so, you know, I think Trump is an easier candidate for the left to attack because he's so out there and gregarious, and against them. Whereas with Hillary Clinton, it's like, yeah, I think if you look at the ideology that Bernie Sanders is putting forward, Hillary Clinton does represent exactly what they profess to be against. But she's still a leftist, so she carries a lot of sway. It shows how collectivistic the left is. And another thing I'll say is this, this might sound a little conspiracy theory-ish, but the thought crossed my mind here is that from Trump's point of view, he doesn't want these protests and all this rigmarole to stop. This gives him the kind of press that's been feeding his campaign the entire time.
Yeah.
Whereas
I mean,
with
that's
Hillary,
the irony I've been pointing out.
This type of press is the last thing Hillary wants if there were protests of this nature. Cause Hillary Clinton, even though she's probably going to win, is out of touch with the real ideology of the left. Like, she's not as much of a leftist as what the left actually wants.
You mean Hillary's going to win the Democratic nomination or she's going to win the whole shebang?
She'll win the nomination. I think Trump will win the general. Unfortunately. Yeah, I do.
No.
Unless there's a brokered convention. If it's Trump versus Hillary, I think it's Trump.
You've heard it here, folks. Then this may go down in history as one of those predictions like Bill Gates saying no one could ever use more than 500 megabytes of storage space. But here we go. If it's Trump v. Hillary, Hillary Clinton wins in a 48-50 state landslide. Not inconceivable that she wins every single state. Yes.
Oh,
because the Republicans will run multiple third parties and they'll tear each other apart. And there's no way that Trump is stealing 25% of the Democratic vote from Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, 48-50%.
You're insider trading right now is what you're doing.
Yeah, right.
You've got knowledge of what the Republicans are going to do if Trump's the nominee. We don't have that knowledge.
Well, I did have that knowledge to some extent, but I'm still running the simulation as just Trump v. Hillary straight up. I still see Trump winning that, to be honest.
Yes,
but
fine.
Daniel does make a really good point. I'm sorry, Daniel!
Fine, Trump wins the popular vote over Hillary Clinton. Clinton wins the Electoral College in every single state.
Yeah.
And we have President Hillary Clinton in a reverse of the Bush-Gore craziness.
Yeah.
Which would be ironic. So I just want to get back to this point for a second that we were making earlier. You do not have freedom of speech to physically block other people from getting to where they want to go.
That's true.
That is not speech.
Nope.
That is you being an asshole who should be arrested immediately.
That's arguably violence.
Yes, absolutely. You do not have a right to impede my movement. That is... At best violence and at worst kidnapping and violence. So, fuck you, protesters. As much as you hate Trump, ironically, even though you are Democrats and supposedly believe in democracy, where people's voices are heard and you get to pick whatever hellish landscape of candidates you want, you do not get to tie yourselves to vehicles in the middle of public roads. I take a really hardline stance against this stuff because I think it is incredibly offensive to do that, and you should be hauled off immediately. I think the police should have jaws of life in their car so they can cut the door off and then throw you on the back of a semi-truck and take you immediately to a landfill and drop you off because that's where you deserve to be. Fuck due process for these people. That's what I say.
Well, you're not throwing them in jail. You're just dumping them off at the landfill. They can still walk home, but that's where they get to go.
With a door on their arm.
To Guantanamo!
I cannot abide this nonsense. One, you're helping Trump, but that's not even the worst of my concerns here. Two, you're a raging asshole. Three, you are also disrupting people who are not necessarily going to a Trump rally.
Lewis.
explode or something.
Oh my god, a light bulb just exploded.
What? It exploded?
Okay, this is very important. Was it a regular light bulb or a new-ass fluorescent light bulb?
I think it was a regular light bulb. Why?
Okay, because it was
in... You'll never have another one ever again. That is one of the last of its species.
Well, it came from South Carolina.
All hail Edison. There you go.
Lab. I'm totally leaving this room too.
Okay, no, but seriously, if one of those newfangled fluorescent energy efficient light bulbs explodes, run. Run, because they're incredibly dangerous.
You
for
didn't
you.
Hear the pop from the light bulb exploding? Is the pop guard?
I did. I thought you snickered.
I thought you had spilled a jar full of marbles, is what I thought it sounded like.
I thought someone had shot a gun of ball bearings at you.
Jesus, that was terrifying. Oh my god. Do we want to go on in the news now?
Justin's lamp is haunted!
That was bizarre. Alright.
The NSA bug exploded. Sorry.
Other crazy things as I try to dig myself out from under all this glass that somehow miraculously did not cut me.
It fell on you? Oh shit!
It's hanging over my head and there was an explosion and everything rained down on me. I was like, what is going on right now?
Wow.
Much like a Trump rally.
Yeah, it was very appropriate.
Yeah.
It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad. 'Cause kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do. While you're dancing like an idiot, they're looking up to you.
Mel Brooks would be rolling over in his grave if he were dead. At the recent news that a high school has removed swastikas from the production of The Producers because they're offensive. Yes. A high school version of The Producers will be missing something in its performance Friday evening, according to CBS New York. The swastikas have been cut from the satirical musical about, yes, Adolf Hitler. If someone's called a swastika on the deck at Tapan Zee High School, it would be treated as a potential hate crime. That helps explain why the stage will be devoid of swastikas when high schoolers present the Mel Brooks musical this weekend. South Orangetown Superintendent Bob Pritchard, who is the whitest white person I've ever whited, says, quote, "There is no context in a public high school where a swastika is appropriate. So, history teachers, please tear those pages from your book and burn them because apparently there is absolutely no context in which a swastika is appropriate in a public high school." Is that not the most asinine comment ever? Not yours, Justin. I'm sure your bleeding's perfectly fine.
I'm not actually bleeding. I was just trying to disrupt.
Man up.
You're just like a Trump rally guy.
I mean, that's the thing.
Seriously.
Like, these educators are trying to act like they can be in charge of people's minds and they're going to context drop that badly?
How could this be construed as a hate crime? Because, like, I understand, like, you know, let's assume for a moment, even within the logic of hate crime, you know, where it's like, okay, if you commit a threat that is racially motivated or, you know, somehow motivated by hatred, just simply having a swastika in a play doesn't amount to any kind of threat. So how could you possibly indicate that as a hate crime? Like, I understand, like, you know, If someone wakes up in the morning, you know, they're a Jew and there's a swastika burned into their lawn. Like, I get that's clearly a threat. And then within the logic of hate crimes, like, that's also could be a hate crime. Of course, I don't believe in hate crimes because the motive for the crime shouldn't matter when it comes to the punishment because that amounts to punishing someone for their ideas. It's the first step towards censorship. But even within the logic of hate crimes, this doesn't make any goddamn sense.
There is just a deep irony to this, right? I mean, anyone familiar with The Producers, it's a show where they're making fun of Nazis. It's a show where they're satirizing Hitler. I mean, how are they going to sing the song, Springtime, for Hitler. He was a Nazi.
I mean, is this
the word Nazi
around?
Is in the song?
Is this coming back around and they're worried about the feelings of Nazis? Is that what this is?
That's a good question. Well, no, dude. They're, but you can't depict the swastika. You know what? You know what's another thing that really bugs me is that the swastika is off limits, and the hammer and sickle is not off limits. Obviously, I think they should both be on limits, if that's even a thing. But it's it just goes to show the cultural corruption the left has produced, that those symbols are not considered equivalent because they, you know, both killed roughly the same amount of people. Well, actually, the Soviet Union killed a hell of a lot more. But still, they're on the same order of magnitude, and they're not considered as such.
Yeah, absolutely. So the principal, the superintendent went on to say, the optic, the visual, to me was very disturbing. I considered it to be an obscenity like any obscenity. What? It's a satire of a historical event. These people existed. They were around. Hitler lived. He had a micropenis.
I just want to know what subject the principal taught before.
Before he became a principal?
Yeah.
I hope not history.
Yeah, or English, or drama, or any sort of art.
No.
I'm sure, I hate to bring this up, but math, a lot of math. Invented by Germans, so a lot of them probably in the Weimar Republic, but none of the math you'd be teaching in high school, actually. Never mind.
So this article also does what I don't like, which is, so in order to get a quote-unquote objective opinion, let's talk to someone who's likely to be offended, who gives us an opposing view.
Yeah!
From Tyler Lowe. Quote, it's satire, not supposed to be taken seriously, said Tyler Lowe, a young Jew. He's not offended by the swastikas in the show. Quote, I personally think Mel Brooks would be honored that the controversy is going on, but I think he would be disappointed by the censorship. So let's, by the way, that last quote was by Orangetown resident Lenora Mesebov. Mesebov? No. Fucking Jew. That person is very clearly a Jew. They had to interview two Jews to get contrary opinions. I hate this shit. It's like if you're not in the offended group, you can't have an objective opinion. I don't like that. It's nonsense.
But Daniel,
I
want
to have a Jew opinion too.
Daniel, I don't think you understand. Projection and conceptualization are impossible. All we're able to do is think in concretes. Just remember. Yeah.
Well,
you know what?
You're the one arguing for abstract thinking.
Awesome. For once. Not that you're not, Justin, that was ridiculous the way you phrased that. He meant, usually it's Justin having to make the argument. Sounded like an insult.
Yeah, well, I was trying. That's what I was going for. Very good.
You're lamp. Yeah.
So here's the deal. Like, here's what I think lies behind this is I think what this is the machine of the leftist truth assassination machine just feeding itself with some of its own people, basically. I mean, these are just high school students trying to have a frickin' play, and they're sacrificing them to this mentality that we need to constantly be on guard. We need to constantly be worried that we're promoting a culture of hatred. We need to further this narrative that we are still an extremely racist, oppressive nation, and that we need it's all to further this narrative. And or these people are just idiots. I mean, half the time, these people just don't know what the hell they're doing, but they're
false
following
dichotomy.
Okay,
both. The answer is both.
Well, but the thing is that the people who come up with these narratives know what they're doing. It's the people who don't have critical thinking skills that end up following them and propagating the ideas. That's at least how I see it.
I just want to know on a practical level, like when these kids in English class are reading the Diary of Anne Frank, is it the fucking one percenters who are coming up to the attic and knocking on the door? When they read War and Peace, do they just skip the war section? Like, what the hell is this? Is history? I'm not over this. It, whatever.
Who think any sort of portrayal of like power and a power structure and a king is fascism. You know? Somehow 300's fascism. These are the way these people think. So stop trying to use logic.
Well, but I mean it's all in order to further this narrative. It's like what I would compare it to, it's like a secular version of original sin. We have to constantly remind everyone that they're always doing something wrong, no matter what they do. They're always somehow hating against these poor minority groups. It's been a while though since, you know, we've seen the Jews represented as one of these, you know, downtrodden groups. I thought they were supposed to be the bad guys, because a lot of them, you know, they got money.
Yeah, those bankers.
Yeah, and a lot of them, you know, white. So
abolish government schools. That's all I have to say.
What do you mean a lot of this shit? Name a non-white Jew.
They're non-white Jews.
That was an in-joke. Let's not make that joke public, but that was an in-joke.
Okay. Let's not make other things public, like Forever 21. Yeah. Forever 21 pulled a t-shirt after critics say it promotes rape.
The shirt promotes rape.
Yes, the shirt in fact said rape 2016.
Is it see-through?
No.
How did this shirt promote rape?
It said the badge is down here, and then an arrow. Yes.
Take me now.
I'm with stupid. Down arrow. No. So, following backlash on social media. Okay, first of all, any story that starts with following backlash on social media might as well say in the next sentence, no one should fucking care. And then that'd be the end of the article. Like, there should be no other news.
So naturally, we're doing a podcast on it.
So here, we're going to spend 25 minutes. Are you ready? Following backlash on social media saying a Forever 21 shirt promoted rape culture, the clothing company has pulled it offline and apologized, according to multiple sources. The plain white t-shirt with black lettering proclaimed, "Don't say maybe if you want to say no," was being sold on Forever21.com for $19.90, which, if you think about it, is a rape of your wallet.
Yeah, for just a white t-shirt that says something.
Fucking white t-shirt. Just take a marker.
I gotta say, as silly as this is, I gotta say, that sentence, don't say maybe if you want to say no, that does sound a little rapey, I gotta admit.
How does that sound rapey? That sounds that is telling people to actually fucking stand by what you believe in. So instead of you fucking stupid people like wanting to say no but don't want to offend people, so you say maybe. That's what that's about. It's got nothing to do with rape.
So I didn't initially think it sounded rapey, and I still don't actually think it sounded rapey. But in my head, I saw this shirt on women. When in fact this was a shirt for men, which makes it on a scale of 1 to a billion, with 1 being not rapey and a billion being 100% rapey, this shirt is a 2. Like,
so how would
it's
it be
not,
rapey
not
if a
rapey.
Woman was wearing a shirt of this shirt? How would it be rapey?
No, I said not rapey. I said because it's a men's shirt, it gets a 2 on the 1 to a billion rapey scale.
On the rapey scale. Now, so I was not even aware that males were federally allowed to shop at Forever 21. But I talked to an actual female about this, and she tells me that some males do go to Forever 21, but they are gay. So
they're
we'll
Bernie Sanders supporters.
They're either Bernie, that's what she said. Their girlfriend around.
Right, and they just keep telling her that. Just stop saying maybe if you're gonna say no, just right. As they're following her around. I do still think it sounds a little rapey. If you were trying to tell people to stick by their beliefs, I feel like you'd say like the vice versa of this statement. You'd say, don't say maybe when you want to say yes. Like that seems, it's like telling people to say yes to life, like if you were trying to go in the reverse. Here's the thing though, I'm sure when they made this t-shirt, clearly, they thought about this for about 6.5 seconds. They're like, oh, I got it. We're gonna, like, don't say maybe unless you wanna say no, or whatever the fuck it is, and then we're gonna print that. People will love it. They will eat this shit up. You know, Bernie Sanders supporters will just love this, cause well, I, it's just, Yeah.
I believe just, the Forever 21 once printed the famous Rourke quote or the Rourke misquote. The question, yes. It's not who's going to let me, it's who's going to stop me.
I believe that's right, yeah.
That once too on a t-shirt, which made people
sounds
mad.
A little rapey if it's on a man. Sounds a little rapey.
Well, I mean, there is that whole scene in the Fountainhead.
Right. So, a couple so things.
Yeah, but Rourke didn't say that before the scene in the Fountainhead.
So,
hey,
so
fix my fireplace.
You. Let me ask you. So the other t-shirt, the one that was the Rourke misquote.
Sorry, hold on. That's an incredible objectivist euphemism. Why don't you come over and fix my fireplace?
Like, I went over and fixed your fireplace. I've used that one before.
I've never heard that. That's an awesome objectivist in-joke. Also a little twisted.
It's pretty good.
Anyway. All right, sorry.
Put that one in the movie. But,
definitely.
So the Rourke misquote, that's the t-shirt he would wear. Is this the one Peter Keating would wear? Don't say maybe when you mean no.
I don't know who would wear this, honestly. I mean, if you look at the model in the photo, he looks like he's a fucking ISIS captive.
Maybe
Jesus.
He was.
So I have a couple things about this. So one, it's not rapey. I mean, to be 100% honest about this, the general you, have to already have a mindset to think about whether or not something sounds rapey, to think that this is a rapey shirt. If we didn't walk around all the time thinking, oh my God, is what I'm going to say offensive or misogynistic or racist or whatever, no one would think twice about this shirt at all.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Number two, the word rapey appears everywhere now. I have heard the word rapey at least 6.5 baker's dozens time in the past 2 weeks. And in every single one of these fucking tweets that they quote in this article, they talk about how the shirt is, quote, rapey. Let's stop making rapey shirts. Horrifying Forever 21 shirt is very rapey. yeah, on and on and on. Rapey, rapey, rapey.
I thought the reason rapey kept coming up over and over again because Raffi named his son rapey. No?
I don't think it's that powerful of a show, Justin. I don't think the League has that much sway over culture.
First of all, but that is not the real Raffi. Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea? Come on, dude. Raffi.
I have honestly no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
All right,
me
next
neither.
Story.
No, wait.
Rapey. Rapey has become the misogynistic word for racist, where now if you're like, hey, this room has a lot of Asian people in it, you're like, dude, that's racist. Don't say that racist shit. It's a fucking observation. Now if you were to say like, oh, that girl's hot. Oh, don't be rapey, dude. Like, it's
I've
not
never
rapey.
Seen that. That's a
and
thing.
It is absolutely a thing.
But he's predicting down the line that people will start saying it in that way. It used to be what you're talking about, Daniel. Is they used to use creepy in this way, right? You know, oh,
yes. You
found that girl attractive, or you say, oh, that girl is a nice ass. Don't be creepy. What's creepy about me having natural urges?
Right. And I did not just say
rape is a natural urge. Fuck you.
Yes, it is. I just want to say one other thing about rapey. So I recently, and I will keep this as utterly vague as possible in order to protect names and whatnot, but I was talking to a potential candidate for a job, and this person said they would not get in a car with Ted Cruz because he had a rapey face. So now, all you have to do as a man is exist, and you can have a rapey face, and forever be known as the guy that this person would not want to go home after a party with in a car, because of your rapey face.
And that's media suggestion too. That's like this whole fucking meme that Ted Cruz is a Zodiac killer. I'm so fucking sick that the left can just create an image of someone on the right, and that people just take that verbatim and repeat it over and over again.
Speaking of things that are repeated over and over again, white people should kill themselves. At least according to Harvard students debating at a recent debate. I honestly don't know what this is. There's a video, by the way, this is at Gateway Pundit. There's a video of two black students debating two white students at Harvard about white privilege. And the debate turns into whether or not white people should kill themselves because of their white privilege. Now, there are many disturbing things about this video, not the least of which is the dress of these students. It's utterly despicable. But other than how they're dressed, it's just ridiculous. All of them should be expelled for how they're dressed at Harvard.
I gotta see this again. But it's just really slop wagon. They're really good. Yeah. It's pretty bad.
It's pretty rapey.
Absolutely.
No, it's like, no, cause like they wouldn't be able to catch up with you if you were running from them. They were trying to rape you. Like they would not rapey actually, but go on.
Yeah. So you should watch the video if you haven't seen it yet. You can search for this on YouTube. More than the content of this video, which is sort of on its face disturbing, the fact that this exchange between these two white kids and two black kids counts as debate, my mind was blown. And in fact, that this was supervised by a professor. The debate is essentially, I think white people's lives, like, are okay. And the black kids go, no, white people should kill themselves. Well, if I'm white, why should I kill myself? Because you're white. Well, why does that mean I should kill myself? Well, because you're white and you have privilege. No one is debating in this video. Not a single ounce of debate happens. You are asserting things. You are saying sentences, then another person says another sentence, and then you say a sentence back, and no one has communicated anything in the form of argument.
We could do a whole episode on the way high school and college debate isn't actually debate. It's all pageantry. That's a whole nother issue. But
I wish this was pageantry. Pageantry.
Peasantry.
I agree with you. So I took the plunge and I went into the YouTube comments here.
And, oh God, I did too.
My God.
I did research on this. And what I found out is this. Two things. One, the black students actually didn't go to Harvard. They went to some school in Georgia, and this was some sort of debate event that was taking place at Harvard. And two, the claim is that they were basically using reductio ad absurdum to point out how absurd their opponent's argument was, and this video was taken out of context. That's the argument they're making. So they were saying that white people should kill themselves to mock the other person's argument.
What argument would that be?
Well, something I noticed is that this video is heavily cut. Like, there's a lot of, like, roughshod, like, breaks between one statement and another, so it's hard to tell what they were actually originally talking about.
I couldn't follow anything any of them were talking about.
Right. And this is the broader point here for me. For me, this is my broader point, and you guys can yes and me if you want, or shut the fuck up no if you want. Whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do. But the broader point for me here is, this is another example of the social media culture we're in, where no one takes any time to digest anything. Everything is instant reactions, or the new phrase I've been seeing on the internet is hot takes. Everyone needs to have a hot take on an issue. They can't actually figure out what's going on and have an educated opinion. It's a race to who has a hot take so then your website can get the most clicks. And this feeds into this, you know, culture we're talking about with the Forever 21 t-shirt here.
Yeah, this is kind of like the right-wing version of that, is what you're saying.
I'm 100% saying that. I'm not kind of saying that.
You're 100% got it. What I call a lot of this type of stuff on both the right and left, although the left, as far as I can see, the left propounds it a lot more heavily because of their more collectivistic and unthinking nature. I call this outrage porn, where it's just like, so where porn here doesn't just refer to, you know, pornographic imagery, rather it refers to something, a particular product that is made to what's the word, indulge a certain interest and only that interest. So what's the difference between porn and, you know, the part in 300 where Leonidas bones his wife is like him boning his wife was part of the plot. Like it wasn't just for the sake of our titillation, although it may have produced that. But it's part of the actual plot, and it's integrated in with the rest of the thing. When it's just porn, it's just there for the sheer titillation. And for this, it's like this doesn't supply us with any kind of intellectual content. It's just there to give us the outrage for the day that we want to, you know, make us feel like, oh, wow, like the world is so fucked up, and, you know, I'm the only one who understands.
Well said.
Yeah.
I couldn't even say that better.
Boobs.
James, now hosting the midside. Made all my points.
Someone who should, someone should not host the midside is David Brooks. For anyone who knows, David Brooks is the, well, I guess you'd call him the token conservative for the New York Times, or what passes as conservatives at the New York Times. He wrote an article this week called The Shame Culture. And like many articles that are of opinion that we choose to highlight here, there are some interesting things that we think are good and some horrible things we think are complete shit.
To hijack for 2 seconds, for me it was like a shit sandwich, and except the shit was the bread and the middle was good. So he like makes a really good point in the middle, but the beginning and end are just shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So here we start. David Brooks, in an article called The Shame Culture. He says, quote, Alan Bloom wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind. The core argument was that American campuses were awash in moral relativism. Subjective personal values had replaced universal moral principles. Now I'm skipping around a bit. Bloom's thesis in 1987 was accurate at the time, but it's not accurate anymore. College campuses today are awash in moral judgment. Many people carefully guard their words, afraid they might transgress one of the norms that they have come into existence. Those accused of incorrect thought face ruinous consequences. When a moral crusade spreads across campus, many students feel compelled to post in support of it on Facebook within minutes. If they do not post, they'll be noticed and condemned. He goes on to say that right now we are in what is called a shame culture. Compare this in its opposition to a guilt culture, where you personally feel bad for having done something, versus a shame culture where people shame you for having done something and you get your moral compass from the other or from the group. So I'll sort of stop there. He goes on to make another point, but let's cover shit and then the meat here. Justin?
Well, for me, I don't care about the shit. I just want to say I think he's identified something good here when he talks about shame culture and he says what it is and how other focused it is. Is that's really what we're living in right now, and we see that, you know, we were just talking about social media and the way that that comes across and controls conversations, is that's really what it is you're racing to shame other people. I mean, we talked about at the top of the show the Trump protest. All that's about is trying to shame people into not voting for Trump, because nowadays that's what motivates people, is what are other people going to think of me? So our number one concern is second-handed. We don't want to be shamed by other people. Even if what we think is right, if other people shame us over it, we don't want a part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you think about how the left does everything, it's all non-intellectual. It's all just like, wait, so I'm supposed to not vote for Trump. Wait, hold on, because you're showing up to his rally and you're screaming. Okay.
Right. Like, right.
Reasoning there. It's purely just an argument from intimidation. It's purely an argument from, hey, a lot of people think ill of you that you hold this opinion.
Right. And I mean, it's even that way when we see the attacks on Man of Steel, right? We just did our episode on that and we'll talk about it probably a little bit more here in the romanticism, the art section. But that's the same way people attack Man of Steel as well and attack Zack Snyder. It's never, you know, logical arguments against him. It's just they create these attacks like, oh, it's, what is it? Oh, I can't remember the word. Drab gray or whatever it is? Grimdark.
Grab.
Grimdark. That's it. His movies are grimdark. Man of Steel is grimdark. And then that's not an argument. That's just used to shame people. How do you like something that's grimdark? Or, that's not Superman. How do you like something that's not Superman? It's done in the same way. I mean, that's what they did with Deflategate, too. How could you stand by the Patriots? What's wrong with you? You know he's obviously lying, and it's intended to make you feel shame. And I know this because that's what they did to me. And what I mean by that is, when I first saw Man of Steel, I fell in love with it. And then I saw all the arguments against it, and I was like, maybe there's something wrong with me. These people really believe this. Maybe there's something wrong with me. And that feeling I'm describing, that's shame. And then I saw it again, and I was like, no, this is a really good movie. And then again, I read the arguments, and again, I felt shame. So what I was participating in there was the shame culture. I was allowing myself to be part of it because I was legitimizing their arguments when they weren't. They were just trying to make me feel a certain way.
Basically, you were having regret or shame in your Man of Steel refractory period, is what
yes,
you're saying.
Exactly.
That's very common. That's nothing to be ashamed of. Yes. So the one thing with this art, everything you've both said is 100% true. The thing I just think
he's kind of hot.
Henry Cavill? Jesus, I'd go gay for him. So the one thing in this article that I want to correct outright is David Brooks says that this is coming from a place of moral judgment and moral absolutism, and I think he couldn't be further from the truth here.
Yeah.
This is coming from a fact that this is coming from the do not judge culture, but it's basically, it is what is a substitute for not being able to judge. You can't judge, but there are things like this that take the place of it, i.e., since there is no truth, it's whatever I feel, that's the only important thing in the world. And I feel aggressed against. I feel demeaned. I feel like you're an oppressor. I feel.
Right.
It comes entirely from individual subjectivism.
Right. And I wrote about that last week when I wrote the article about the film critic who claimed that all film criticism was just the critic's experience with the movie. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And you can tell that David Brooks here is the token what passed for conservative at the Times, because he ends the article with this, not ends, but pretty close to ends with this nonsense. On the positive side, this new shame culture might rebind the social and communal fabric. It might reverse a bit the individualistic, atomizing thrust of the past 50 years.
When I read that, I wanted to throw my laptop across the room.
Yes.
It's pretty impressive that somehow second-handedness is the fault of individualism. Somehow being shamed by the group and wanting to be part of the group so you subjugate your opinions to the group, that's somehow the fault of individualism. It's really
twisted.
Oh
no, that's not what he's saying. He's saying that like if we subjugate our opinions to the will of the group, as this shame culture is promoting, then we will be less individualistic and, you know, thinking people, and we'll all just get to, you know, get along as fellow slaves, I guess.
Well, listener Katrina just really perked up at your use of the word slaves there, because she's been listening to Stefan Molyneux a lot, so I think you just hit on something that's really going to work with our audience. But no, I agree with you completely, but I'm saying the suppressed premise in what you just said, his conclusion, is also that individualism led to shame culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, earlier, if you take into account the do not judge thing, I think you are right. I just think his view of what causes these things and what the cure is and what's good about them is so unbelievably disconnected from reality that, I don't know. The fact that he is one of the leading conservative columnists in the world is frightening. I don't even consider myself a conservative, but if I did, I would burn the New York Times to the ground for this nonsense.
I mean, it's because of guys like this that I'm no longer conservative.
Yeah,
I mean,
this is
what it comes down to, is this kind of pandering to the enemy and half measures and like, yeah, we're interested in the consequences of individualism, but we're not, you know, willing to think for ourselves all the way. Like, this is all just a result of being a conservative. It's just how
the Russell Kirk kind of conservatism nonsense. Anyway, hope you're ashamed of yourself, gentlemen.
Well,
sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, if people expected us to feel shame, they should definitely turn off right now, because we're going to go into the romanticism segment, which we're not ashamed about, the things we're going to talk about this week, at least. I don't think Daniel will be ashamed of the thing he's reviewing. That's my guess. Let's find out in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. All right, Daniel, let's start this segment off with a review here. You saw the movie Zootopia, correct?
I did. I saw it with my own eyes.
So you are a bit of an animated movie aficionado, maybe an expert, if you will. And this is what we're going to do. Since you are so sick of our rating system, I'm going to say, give us your review and then rate it 1 through 10. Is that enough? Is that enough choices for you?
I get all the way through 10?
Yes, you get 10 choices.
What will I do with the extra 7? My God. It's incredible. Okay, so Zootopia is a Disney animation that's getting quite a bit of hype, and I think deservedly so for the most part. Basically, it takes place in an alternate universe where animals have evolved to basically be like humans, i.e. they use their mind to solve problems, and they sort of give up their animalistic instincts. The IMDb summary is, in a city of anthropomorphic animals, a rookie bunny cop and a cynical con artist fox must work together to uncover a conspiracy. So the main character is Judy Hopps.
Is it the movie Ride Along, except with animals?
That is such a fucking... I'm surprised at how much, like, detail and intricacy there is. Like, they have to have a backstory as to why all the characters are animals. Like, can't you just say it's a fucking kids movie? They're just fucking animals. Like, that's what they did in Robin Hood. They didn't need to say, like, the king is a lion because, you know, in a genetic experiment gone wrong, the king turned into a lion. No! He's just a fucking lion. He's the king. Robin Hood's a fox, naturally.
In this, the mayor is a lion, so...
There you go.
So there's a,
hey,
there's
that
a...
That is culturally, that's racist, alright? That's animalist. Why does the lion always get to be the fucking king? Huh? Why is
he
always a leader?
Gentlemen, you have both unwittingly and unknowingly, revealed two of the most important parts of the plot of the movie. Huh. That's right, both of you have, just now. So here's the thing.
They give part of a backstory.
Like,
was this a magic trick?
Little bit. We'll talk about magic in a moment, but a little bit. So part of the reason they explain the backstory is that part of the mystery that the lead character, Judy Hopps, who is the first rabbit police officer in the history of Zootopia, the part of the mystery they have to unravel is animals, i.e. people in this movie, are suddenly turning savage, is what they call it, and reverting back to their animalistic instincts, and they don't know why. And then these people are disappearing.
Which is kind
of that's
awesome
part of the mystery.
Because on the internet nowadays, when you do something like really like animalistic or fucked up, they say you're being savage. So,
yeah, savage. So that's part of the mystery. And then the other element here about what you're saying about lion and why the lion gets to always be it is that the only animals that are turning savage are the predator animals, and so they set up this dichotomy in Zootopia between the predators and the prey. Now, in the civilized Zootopia, the predators and the prey get along, but the predators are of the 10%, and they're the ones that get the jobs like mayor and police officer and sort of the status jobs in the culture, while the prey get all the shitty jobs like workers and assistants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you start to see the dichotomy they're setting up. Yes? It is your show.
This movie isn't going to piss me off, is it? Because... this sounds like the traditional, like, and this is actually something that I concretized in my unpublished novel that people don't know about, if you may remember this, Daniel Timeless, where I talked about how people believe in the exploiters and the exploited. I mean, this sounds 100% the same thing.
Yes, that's what I was beginning to think when I saw the movie, and I thought, oh, this is going to be another one of these children's propaganda films about this. But, and here we go with spoiler alert.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
The movie ends with an incredible twist on this story, which is that one of the prey, the assistant mayor who is portrayed as a little lamb, is the one who has scientifically engineered this stuff to make the prey go savage so that she can gang the 90% up on the 10% and take over those jobs.
Wait, so this is a conservative movie? Like...
I mean, it was an incredible twist on this. Like, her explicit plot is, there are so many of us and so few of them, why shouldn't we all unify against one enemy?
So this is like this year's Kingsman movie, basically.
Yeah, where there's sort of a surprise ideological twist in the movie.
Right, and the villain actually is explicitly ideological leftist, and it's unexpected.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So that was a surprising twist. That's sort of the good stuff about the movie. I would say the other good stuff about the movie is that the characterizations are done very well. The mythology of the universe is done very well. They put painstaking thought into how an actual world would look like if you had to deal with really tall creatures who bought things from shops and really small creatures who also rode the metro with you, and how you would deal with cars and how the city would be laid out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all that is fun to witness on the screen. The movie, the plotting, the writing of the plot, while the plot points are interesting, the way they get from one plot point to the next, I don't think they understood what plot integration with the story was. It just seems like there's a scene, and then they're at a dead end, and then something random happens, and they're like, oh, now we get to go on to the next part of the plot. And then they get a dead end, and it's like, oh, something random happened, so now we get to go on to the next part of the plot.
This is what I like sort of to call the hangover effect. And what I mean by that is, ever since the success of The Hangover, that formula has been used a lot. You also see this in the show Cooper Barrett's Guide to Surviving Life, where they're doing that because they think it mirrors life and it mirrors unpredictability, and that's what The Hangover did, where whenever they ran out of something to do, they just put in some other ridiculous thing happening to them.
Yeah, so that's how the plot is unveiled. It's not unveiled like a traditional mystery where there are clues that are solved by people who are smart. It's just sort of like this random event happens and then you get more information.
100%
that pisses me off.
100% The Hangover. The Hangover was supposed to be a mystery too, that they figured out why they were drunk, what happened the night before, and like you said, it was just random shit happening.
Yeah. So there are a couple other, there's one other failure that I want to mention and then one other good thing and then I'll rate it. So the second failure is that it is foremost a children's movie, but much of the humor that's written to this movie, children just did not get. In the theater I was in, for instance, like the now famous scene of the DMV where all the DMV employees are sloths, that's very clever and it's very well done. I don't think a single child knew what the hell was going on. Like, all the parents were laughing uproariously, and the kids were just like, are you all drunk?
I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So, there's that. So that's the other sort of failing. And then I'll say one other good thing about this, which is most animated movies now basically rely on really overwritten humor to be effective. And this movie, while it had humorous scenes, did not rely on humor to be an effective story. In fact, many of the scenes for long periods of time went without a laugh on purpose because they were very serious and dealt with actually really serious or nearly traumatic issues in a almost Bambi-like sense. And I think that was on purpose since the movie is about animals. So I really applaud Disney for doing that in a children's movie that isn't laugh after laugh after laugh after laugh. So overall, I think the film has some weaknesses, some strengths. I would say it's probably are you ready for this? A 7!
There we go. See, you used it. You used it.
That's right.
We don't have a sound clip for 7.
Oh.
This is 7!
So it's enjoyable. I think the acting is good. Jason Bateman is stars as a fox. He's delightful, and the main character Bunny is delightful. All the characters are pretty darn good. So you should see it. There's going to be a billion sequels. because it made a lot of
money
already.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, it's made like $600 worldwide. $600 million worldwide. I think it's almost as successful as Deadpool at this point.
Yeah, they're going to make a lot of sequels out of this, especially because you could do unlimited franchise movies. You could do a fox movie and a bunny movie and an antelope movie and whatever the fuck else.
I just want to see the one where the deer sees his mother get shot. I want to see that one.
I just want to know if the fox and the bunny are going to do it and have interracial babies. I don't know how that works.
All right,
predator prey babies.
Let's take down some trailers.
On that note.
Ready to take down some trailers?
Take down.
All right. So there were three big trailers that came out this past week. The first one is for the sequel to Now You See Me. Now You See Me 2, the second act. You know, rather than call it Now You Don't, they call it the second act. So whatever. What did you guys think of this trailer?
I barely knew this was a movie, let alone a sequel. Like, this was a movie popular enough that it deserved another one.
Yes, this movie did surprisingly well. For the people like Daniel who don't know, it's about these four magicians who are very talented, and they're drafted, basically. They get these notes that are like, you're going to be in the secret society if you become the four horsemen and you use magic to commit these acts. And then, of course, there's a twist at the end because it's a magic movie, and every magic movie needs a twist in the third act. But it stars Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, and in the first one, it was Isla Fisher. This one stars Lizzie Kaplan. And, of course, it also stars Dave Franco.
Oh, now I know why you like this movie. Another Henry Cavill situation. Also, Morgan Freeman, by the way. Morgan Freeman's in it.
And also Michael Caine is in it as well. And then there's the big payoff to the trailer, which I thought was ridiculous. And I think it's a really ridiculous career move. At the end of it is Harry Potter. What's his name?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah,
that was pretty funny.
Daniel Radcliffe is the money shot to this trailer. And it's like, why, if you were Harry Potter, would you ever star in another magic movie for the next 30 years?
Oh, come on. I mean, it's not the same because the magic isn't real magic in this movie.
As opposed to Harry Potter words.
Where it's real magic, because, you know, that's the magic that actually exists, as opposed to illusions, Michael. Those are the magics that don't exist.
So based off
Tricks
this trailer...
are a thing a whore does for money.
Based off this trailer and any prior knowledge you may have had, would you see this movie?
No.
I would see it. I kind of liked the first one. I actually didn't like the ending, but it was fun. It was definitely fun throughout. I'll see this movie. This looks the same as the first, to be honest with you, though.
Justin,
with
has
that glowing review.
Justin has a hard-on for time travel movies, but I'm beginning to see that he also has a hard-on for magic.
What else are you referring to?
Well, you like Penn and Teller and The Prestige. Like, you just seem to have a little bit of a thing for magic.
I think this is an unquestioned preference I have that I've never realized before.
Yeah.
But look
just
at the
a
cast.
Little one.
Look
just,
at the cast.
Just
look
like
at,
a...
Look at the cast.
Just like a half-chub for magic, not a full-on.
Woody Harrelson, you know. Jesse Eisenberg. That's two of the people from Zombieland, right? they replaced Isla Fisher with an upgrade, Lizzie Kaplan, who's fucking hilarious and hot, and Dave Franco. And then Michael Caine and Morgan Freeman. Won't you just see that movie based on the cast?
No. Okay. It's about magicians, and I don't care.
All right, next trailer. X-Men Apocalypse finally released its trailer. What did you guys think, and would you see the movie based on the trailer?
Wait. Finally released its trailer, or released its final trailer? Because
no.
I've seen, like, 300 trailers.
Right,
for
but this
X-Men
is their
Apocalypse.
Official trailer. All the other ones weren't their official trailer.
Oh, I didn't even watch it because I assumed it was the same goddamn trailer I've seen a billion times.
No, this is a new one. You see all the mutants and everything except Jubilee. We need more Jubilee.
What do you mean you see all the mutants? I saw the mutants in the other trailer. What are we talking about?
Do you see the X-Men Apocalypse trailer they released this past week? Did you click the link and watch it?
No, because I thought I'd seen it a billion times and it's terrible.
Oh, come on.
Does the trailer end with a bald Professor Xavier?
No.
Oh.
This is a new one.
because the big reveal in the first trailer was, oh, he's bald now. Okay, yeah. Fantastic. What a money shot. Thank you.
I can see why you think that's a little lame. I'm definitely watching this movie only because Michael Fassbender Magneto is in it, who's my favorite superhero. From X-Men First Class.
I've seen every shitty X-Men movie there is, except for Wolverine's Origin, which I refuse. But I will see this shitty X-Men movie
too. That's not true. You haven't seen the Wolverine either, where Wolverine goes to Japan.
I just said, Justin, I haven't seen the X-Men Wolverine Origin story.
There's two of them. There's the one with Ryan.
There's two of them?
Yes, there's where they decided to do Deadpool and show his sew his mouth shut with Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool, because they thought that would be
a good
idea.
In the origin story?
Yes, that's in that origin. And then there's another one where he goes to Japan. That's a different one.
Really?
Yes. Those are two different movies.
Okay, I refuse to see shitty Wolverine movies, but I'll see the rest of the terrible X-Men movies.
I have to say, the thing that annoys me the most about these is how they have to shoehorn Jennifer Lawrence in as if her character was ever that important, but because she's such a big actress, they make her character super important in these movies, and that's fucking annoying.
I bet she makes more than a lot of her male counterparts in these movies.
That's probably true.
It's not fair!
Yeah, I'll not equitable.
It. Because the movie will actually have Jubilee in it, unlike the trailer, so I will see it.
Jubilee shoots fireworks from her fingertips. Whee!
Okay, so final trailer. Seth Rogen released the trailer for Sausage Party. And this movie is basically like Toy Story for lunch meats and meats in the grocery store.
Toy Story for liverwurst.
Yes. What would you guys think of the trailer, and would you see this movie?
Completely taken by surprise. All I saw, I didn't see the name of the movie. All I saw on Facebook was a video, and the still was just a grocery store with animated food. And I was like, oh, what is this?
Oh, no.
And I was like, did he just say the fuck word in a trailer? I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was very clever. My only concern is how do you, okay, for anyone who hasn't seen this trailer, by the way, talking food, all they want in life is to be taken home by humans, and then when they finally are, they learn the dastardly truth that humans eat them. And the food are sentient. So like, for instance, there's a bowl of baby carrots that the woman is munching on, and they're like, oh my fuck, they're eating children!
It's pretty much like when you bring a girl home from the bar.
It's exactly like that, yeah, every single time. The type of mayhem and horror that happened in this trailer is pretty much what taking a girl home from the bar is like every
all
time.
They go to the bar and all they want is for some guy to take them home. And then when they go home with the guy, they realize how horrible it is. That's all I'm saying.
What are you doing to women in your home, Hannibal? Jesus.
I prefer Dexter as an insult. But if you're gonna give me that much of a compliment, then thank you.
Eat the bitches. I look forward to this. This is my, I see what I did there. The concern I have is how do you sustain an entire movie on this premise when you sort of know, like, what it, like, you know that the food finds out that it's horrible and that it's gonna be bad. And it's just one running gag. How is there a movie made out of this? Like a 10-minute short I could see, but a whole movie?
I could see them making a movie out of this because, like, there's a hint of this in the trailer in that there's a hint that their little illusion they're under kind of mirrors religion. It's kind of like a pleasant lie.
Ooh.
There is a hint of that. Like he's talking to a food that appears to be like a priest food, and he says, oh, you shouldn't break the news to everyone because then they'll just be, you know, everyone will be horrified. He's like, but then they'll die. And he's like, oh yeah, dude, you're right. Like it's sort of funny, but at the same time, like it does mirror a real situation in our culture that, you know, God eats us when we die. No, but that, you know, that religion is harmful to human life, but it's a pleasant story, you know, telling us we have eternal life.
I mean, I think the broader point to back up James here is everything Seth Rogen does and James Franco, they usually do movies together, or it's more Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg who are co-writing. It doesn't seem like it would have some broader thematic point, but it does. I mean, The Dictator did not look like it would have a broader thematic point. It looked like it would just be them, the same joke over and over again about North Korea. Superbad.
You mean The Interview?
Yeah, The Interview, sorry. Sorry, The Dictator was a stupid movie I won't see.
Sacha Baron.
Yeah, because I hate that guy. Yes, The Interview. Thank you, James, for correcting me. I missed.
How do you hate Sacha Baron Cohen?
Because I think he is unnecessarily crass. I don't think he earns his crassness. I think he is crass for the sake of being crass.
In Talladega Nights, when he's like, I drive Formula One.
I will not see a Will Ferrell movie.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, the point I was making, even in Superbad seems like it's just about high school kids trying to lose their virginity, you know, going to parties. But there's a legitimate thematic point in there, and it says a lot.
Yes, it's about high school kids who want to lose their virginity while also smoking pot.
Yes, that's what the movie's about.
Very complex.
I will see this movie because I think it will have thematic depth to it, and I'm interested in how they execute it.
Speaking of execute, that potato peeling scene was awesome.
Oh my God. I actually won't see this movie because I really don't like dark humor. I'm on board with everything you guys are saying, but it's just not my preference. Like, this preview actually really bothered me. Like, I couldn't sleep. This preview owes me an entire night of sleep.
Wow.
James, the sensitive one. Ladies, listen up.
Triggered.
Yeah, they should have a trigger warning all over this.
All right. So let's move on to the most important news of ever. So the Batman versus Superman press is in full, the press tour is in full swing right now. So, of course, Zack Snyder is doing interviews everywhere. And in The Hollywood Reporter, they asked him, do you have time to develop anything outside of the DC universe, basically? And this is what he replied. I have been working on The Fountainhead. I've always felt like The Fountainhead was such a thesis on the creative process and what it is to create something. Warner Brothers owns the script, which was, of course, written by Ayn Rand, and I've just been working on that a little bit. Gentlemen, question for you. How do I contain my excitement? But is he right about what The Fountainhead's about, or are people going to be mad because he didn't say The Fountainhead is about individualism versus collectivism in a man's soul?
One, don't contain your excitement. Two, it would have been way cooler if he said, no, I'm not working on anything outside the DC universe, but I am bringing Howard Rourke into it.
Howard Rourke joins the Justice League.
He's the hero the city deserves. Dynamiting buildings all over. And then three, of course, objectivists are going to be upset if it is not. Basically, they will be upset if he doesn't frame for frame refilm the King Vidor version of this of the Fountainhead that Ayn Rand sort of oversaw. If it is anything other than a shot-for-shot remake, they'll be upset. And that's okay, because he's not making it for them. What? No, he's not. Not at all. He's making it for a new audience. He's making it for himself.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think if Zack Snyder's movies are any indication, I think he may miss some of the deeper points that the novel has, but that's okay. Ooh. It's a movie. It's just... Hold on, Justin. Hold on, for fuck's sake.
I think I just had a heart attack,
fucking
dude.
For fuck's sake. He may miss them, but that's the thing is that that's to be expected in a movie. It's such a more compacted medium. He's got to get a lot more done in a lot less time. But that being said, I'm sure he'll have a take on this work that an objectivist should appreciate.
So are we okay with his description of it?
Yeah,
a thesis
I am.
On the creative process and what it is to create something. We're okay with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm okay with it in that I think it will produce, that viewpoint will produce a great movie. I'm not okay with it in the sense that, like, no, that's not the theme of the book. But it's like, but hey, if that's his interpretation of it, I think it'll make a great movie. I really do. I, like I said, though, I think, you know, that does miss the primary purpose of the book, though.
Right. If he had come out and said something like, I'm doing The Fountainhead because it's a wonderful thesis about how we should all get along and how we should compromise on our core ideals.
Yeah, it's nothing like that.
But we should be up in arms and be like, fuck you, Zack Snyder, you're a fraud.
But yeah, like he's identifying part of the book that is there. And he's identifying something that is true to Ayn Rand's vision. It's just not the primary thrust of it. Right. It's not like in fucking the second Atlas Shrugged movie where Dagny Taggart says like, who is John Gall? And like, you know, it's just like that one part. And like, I saw that when I was 22. I'm like, fuck you guys. A 22-year-old who's been studying objectivism for 2 years, me at the time, knows more about objectivism than you fucking do because, you know, they have Dagny like, you know, who is John Galt? Which is exactly the opposite of how she says that phrase as she's crashing the plane. Anyway, that always bugged me. I had to get that out there. It won't be anything like that. It'll be great. It won't be as deep as the book, I think, but it will be beautiful.
Well, here's the thing. This is what I want.
And I mean, if it happens, the culture will be saved. That's the main deal here. I mean, the culture will be saved.
Here's context I want to add.
We will suddenly become a capitalist paradise as soon as this movie's released.
Here's context I want to add to this. Ready? So I want to add the context of what we know about Zack Snyder to his statement about a thesis on the creative process and what it is to create something. Knowing that he said, I make movies for myself. And knowing that he said, I have an Ayn Rand aesthetic. And knowing he has said that it's very important in this interview with the Hollywood Reporter, he said, it's important that we let each filmmaker have his own individual voice in his films. Don't you think individualism versus collectivism in the soul will be in there?
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's apparent that it won't be the primary theme. If he's really expressing to us the exact terms in which he thinks about this. But you're right, it will be in there.
Yes, and I actually 100% agree with James, but I just want to reiterate, I don't think this is a bad thing at all.
Oh no, this is fucking spectacular. The culture will be saved.
I think when...
Wow, you're taking a harder line stance than I am. I just wanted to ejaculate in the theater.
No, I mean, I'm kidding, of course, but I mean, this would be amazing. I think, you know, it'll be amazing. Absolutely stunning.
When you're adapting something as dense as a book, and especially as dense, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm not saying dense as a pejorative. A book as The Fountainhead, you have to pick something that translates to the visual medium in order to run with that as your theme. You can't do multiple complex many themes unless you're going to do multiple movies or you're going to do a Gods and Generals 7-hour long epic movie. Like, you just can't do it. And I think what he is picked here for this theme is about as fucking good as you could do to make this movie into something that had mainstream success in a normal runtime movie. I think that he has captured something from the book that translates beautifully to the visual medium, and I applaud him for that.
I love it. You guys are doing
Justin,
all my... Well, I had the mute button on and didn't realize it. I love it. You guys are doing all my work for me. I was just listening to what you were saying, and I can't say it any better. So you guys have made me okay with being super excited about this.
Yeah, dude. I mean, imagine, here's the way I'm thinking about it. The three Atlas Shrugged movies, they focused on the political aspect of Atlas Shrugged, which is not the primary aspect of Atlas Shrugged, right? Like, it's not primarily political. It's right. Primarily philosophical, but there is, of course, a political aspect. If they had focused, if I could imagine in a different parallel universe where Michio Kaku doesn't exist, not that that would be related, but in a different parallel universe, where this movie, those three Atlas Shrugged movies were actually good, but they still focused on the political. It would not, in a sense, be as good as the book, but it would be a true adaptation of the book that focuses on the political themes, even though, because they basically say, okay, like, basically they're saying, we want to make an Atlas Shrugged movie, but we're not going to be, we're going to, you know, sort of, we're not going to bite off too much we're not going to bite off more than we can chew. We're going to focus on the political aspect of this. I could understand them doing that.
I actually think that's a great point about this too. I think that the good thing about having Snyder in charge of this is he's more likely not to go the political route, which will make it a better movie. Like, if they had not gone the political route with Atlas Shrugged, it would have been a much better trilogy, but they decided to go that route.
I agree. Right. I'm just saying, like, it's okay that they did that. It's they just fucked everything else up about that movie was the problem.
Oh, I agree. So I was just using it as a way to defend Snyder
right.
and celebrate Snyder.
Right. I agree with you there, just that I mean, you know, the political message is out there, you know. Libertarians have it, and you know, they don't stick to it as well as they should, but we need to put out the spiritual message of objectivism. And that's what a movie like this would definitely do.
Well, and that's what Zack Snyder's been doing with all his movies. I mean, Man of Steel was the spiritual part of objectivism, and Batman vs. Superman, I believe, will be as well. So.
Alright, well, this could be a defining moment if he really does go through with this. I mean, lots of movies are in various stages of production, and they never get made for whatever reason, but this would be a huge deal. It would be a huge deal.
I agree. So, we'll see what happens with that, and I think that's a really good point, Daniel. It might not get made, but reason to be excited that he even talked about it. Let's see what else people are talking about on the internet, and head into Reddit on Reddit. Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA blows, Steam rocks, got Res for my Firefox. See, these things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it. First Reddit, and Daniel, this is right up your alley. I put two of these in here for you. We're doing the mild and interesting every week now. That'll be the third one here. But the first one's in here for you, because I think it's important we address this. This is under the political subreddit, and it says, six justices on the U.S. Supreme Court have been confirmed in presidential election years since 1912. So, Daniel, go. Respond.
Yeah, so, okay, so there are a couple of things. One, the facts here aren't exactly true. They're being a little bit coy with the language, though they're not entirely wrong. And I'll get to the facts of this momentarily. The second part is, and this is something Republicans need to listen to as much as Democrats, shouldn't fucking matter. Shouldn't matter what the precedent is, should matter what the principle is, and we'll talk about that momentarily. So I pulled up a Cato article that I really like. You can find this at cato.org/blog. It's called A Few Facts on Election Year Nominations and Confirmations to the Supreme Court. And they go through an exhaustive history of these. So I'm going to read one paragraph, will be as quick as possible. Looking at the history of the matter since 1900, until last week, only four vacancies have occurred during an election year. Two in 1916, one in 1932, and one in 1956. Three more occurred during the previous year, 1911, 1939, and 1987. The nominees in each case were confirmed respectively in February, early January, and early February of the election year that followed. So part of the thing about this is you get the six justices number, and you have to put it together with confirmed in a presidential election year. But that doesn't mean they were nominated in an election year. And also you give up the fact that this exact situation we have now has actually never happened. In the modern era, there has been no close parallel to the situation today when the presidential primary elections are already underway. The White House and the Senate are held by different parties. The parties are deeply divided, and the most recent off-year election reflected that divide very clearly, meaning the off-year election elected Republicans to a democratically controlled, against a democratically controlled executive branch. So those are the facts that we're dealing with. I think those facts are interesting historically and might lead your thinking on this matter, but the principle is essentially, should this person sit on the Supreme Court? And I think that's what we miss in all this. I think the Republicans had a terrible strategy when they came out and said, nope, we're not even going to hold a hearing. Fuck you. We're never going to think about this. Whoever you nominate can go sit on a stick because we're just never going to consider him. And that gave the Democrats all of the political momentum in the entire world. It put everything on their side. The Republicans should have come out and said, look, the president has a duty to nominate someone. That's great. He should take his time, seriously consider it. And then when he sends us a nominee, we will take our time, seriously consider him. And at some point, he will get an up or down vote. What is so difficult about that? What is so difficult about that thinking, Republicans? I don't know.
Why do you think they failed to do it that way? And why is it that it gives the left momentum for them to do it the way they did do it?
Because there is a brush that the right gets painted with, and to some degree it's true, and in some degrees it's not true because the right doesn't know how to spin it, basically. And that is the brush of obstructionism. Being an obstructionist is something that is universally hated among the right and the left of the general electorate, not necessarily among libertarians or objectivists or people who understand that we need to goddamn obstruct everything the government's trying to do. But people don't like when politicians say no just to say no. And the Republicans get painted with this brush all the goddamn time, and they don't know how to fucking respond. They just get painted with the brush of nope, 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 nope. And they have no principled arguments on which to say why they are saying no, or to present a positive, aspirational yes to something else, to an alternative. So it gives the Democrats all of the momentum because the Republicans come out with the default stance of no. You could say, and in fact, Ted Cruz, who the guy I'm supporting for president, came out and said, you could nominate the most conservative, Reagan-esque, Federalist Society judge that exists. I am going to filibuster his nomination. That is the quintessential definition of obstructionism, if it has any meaning whatsoever. And that gives all the political momentum to the Democrats, who can now put a qualified candidate after qualified candidate, none of them getting a vote, and they can score political points off that, to infinity, to the next election.
Yeah, damn. It seems like the Republicans just, it's like they're painted with this brush, but then it's like they're going Donald Trump. They're just saying like, oh, hey, you think I'm a greedy bastard that doesn't care about, you know, minorities and I'm a racist? Well, fuck you. That's exactly what I'm going to be. Like, you think I'm an obstructionist who just is against everything for no reason? Well, fuck you. That's what I'll do. Like, I wasn't, but now I am.
It's like me.
Exactly.
Undergrad.
That's right. Just like that. You think I'm a loner who can't get a girl? Well, fuck you. I'm going to be more alone and not get any women.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
All right. So let's go on to the last Reddit here. We're going to do the mildly interesting for Daniel. The mildly interesting this week is, at my university, there is a realistic sticker of a fly in the urinal, so to trick men into peeing on it and in turn keeping the floors clean. And they have a picture of it on the Reddit here.
That you're right. That is mildly interesting, indeed.
My thing about
also,
this
we are
is,
looking at a urinal with pee on it. Great.
My thing about this is, why can people just not fucking pee on the floor? Like, why do you need like a fly to aim at? Like, is it that hard to not pee on the floor?
I think this is going to be really nerdy of me, but actually when this design was first unveiled, it was more like when we were in grad school. And it's not so much that the fly is there for people to say, hey, piss on the urinal. The fly is actually at a spot that is supposed to create the least splashback.
Like they did the fluid dynamics of flowing urine on this?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
So that is,
I can respect that.
That is the purpose of the fly. I mean, it's not like if there's no fly, guys are like, well, where do I put my wiener? And it's like, just piss on the guy standing next to him. Like, men got along with urinals without flies for a very long time. Also, I feel like the fly pants and the fly urinal thing, that's going to create a distraction. They just should have put a bullseye. Okay. Yeah, yeah. What self-respecting man wouldn't just aim at a fucking bullseye? Also, this encourages vegans to piss on the floor.
Right, yeah, yeah. I was going to say, there's all these comments about, like, oh, what if we don't want to piss on the fly? I'm like, come on, get a load of these people. Like, you know, what little boy doesn't grow up psyched about the fact that his dick is basically, a, you know, a bio squirt gun he gets to piss on stuff with?
You either overestimate or underestimate vegans. One of the two. Fucking hippies.
I just purely estimate them.
All right. All right. What did we learn this week, Daniel?
Well, I learned that people think that the fly is something you're supposed to aim at because it encourages people to piss in the urinal. Like, I don't know. That was a dumb reason for me to have a fly. I never thought that. It was always a fluid dynamic thing. I don't know. I'm a designer.
James?
I learned the degree to which I am just horrified by the humor in Sausage Party or just anything like that. Like, I kind of always knew stuff like that bothered me. But, like, mixing bodily mutilation with humor has never sat well with me. Like, even in the fucking hilarious movie Tropic Thunder, and the part where the guy gets his head blown off and then another guy gets his arms blown off, like, I just could not find those parts funny. So sorry to be such a buzzkill.
Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned that it's okay to be excited about Zack Snyder making The Fountainhead. No, I'm being facetious. I was just playing coy with that to get you guys to say why and have me not say it, because it would be less reliable if I said it.
No one listens to this show thinking that your opinion is at all reliable.
You new age journalist bastard.
That my Snyder love is so over the top that people wouldn't have taken me seriously. So I needed, it was an ethos point.
You throwing around your fancy words like ethos. Who do you think you are, some ivory tower academic?
No.
Good. If you are also excited about the Zack Snyder movie, you should tell the world. You should tell the world by talking to us on Twitter. Yes, I don't want to use the impersonal engage with us on social media. What the fuck does that mean? Come chat with us on Twitter. Come start up a conversation on Facebook. Come tell us how much you love us on patreon.com/themidside. Don't engage, enrage people with your love of Zack Snyder and the Midside. Tell a friend, tell your enemy, tell your boss, tell your quasi-sentient pet, whatever it is that can listen to us every week. Tell them about the podcast. That's how we grow. That's how we take over the world. And that is how we eventually get to co-direct the Atlas Shrugged, new Atlas Shrugged movies with Zack Snyder when he does them in 2031 or something.
Just to be clear, Zach, so, I only want to write it. I don't want to co-direct it. Don't listen to him. You can have the directing credits.
I don't want to co-direct with Zack Snyder. I just want to be there. No, I'm not done. Do you think I'm done? Did it sound like I was done?
You can be there all you want.
I was not done.
Okay, go.
Can I finish? Can I finish? Can I finish? Okay, I'm finished.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Yay!
I have to cut that out, you know, jackass.
No! It goes at the end.